We're just going to read from Exodus chapter 1. So we're starting at verse 6. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died. But the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. Look, he said to his people, the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, and they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramesses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The land of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwife, the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him, and if it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live? The midwives answered Pharaoh, Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive. So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that is born, you must throw into the Nile, and let every girl live. Now a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him.
So yeah, over the last number of weeks, we've been looking at new beginnings. We've looked at those people that Katrina mentioned. New beginnings, and then last week we heard Cameron Horner talking about life, a new beginning for him with his accident and so on, how God has used that and worked through him since that. But we're starting a new series today in the book of Exodus that will take us up to Easter, up to Passover. I suppose the book of Exodus can be seen as a journey into new life. That is exactly what it is. It is a road into new life. It's going to be a new beginning for these people. And it's a wonderful picture of what it means to know God in your life. It's a picture of what it means for us to come from Egypt into the land of promise, led by God, blessed by God. So that's what the book of Exodus is really about. It looks forward to Jesus coming. That's the kind of big picture. Moses is a type of Jesus. We are the type of Israel. We are enslaved, looking forward to the promised land. But he begins life in Egypt. The book of Exodus is a continuation of the book of Genesis. You might think that, but it actually is. The book of Genesis finishes with, well, we know about Joseph, who had been sold into slavery by his brothers. He'd been taken there. He became the second most powerful man in Egypt. The famine came. His brothers came looking for food. You know the story. And how the whole family were brought to Egypt during the famine. There were 70 of them. Only 70. It's not a great big number. It's big enough, I suppose. But not as big as it's going to become, because a little family that entered Egypt would become a nation who would leave Egypt, become a nation chosen by God. But the book of Exodus picks that up, because the first word in Hebrew in the book of Exodus is the word and. And these are the names of the people who came. 70 people came, and these are the names of the people who came. So it's a great record of those people who had come. But only 70 came. Then verse 7, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous. The Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly. Do you recognize that language? Became fruitful. It's meant to make you think back into the book of Genesis. And it's all over Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, Adam and Eve were told by God, be fruitful and multiply. Then God said to Noah after the flood, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Genesis 22, God said to Abraham, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. Genesis 35, God changes Jacob's name to Israel and he says to him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. So God, his command to people then and to people today is to be fruitful and multiply. It hasn't changed. And if you look into the New Testament, how do we become fruitful? Wonderful passages like Galatians 5, to have the fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, self-control, all these wonderful things that are qualities. This is the fruit that God wants to see develop in our lives. But more than that, he wants to share that. The last words of Jesus were to his disciples and are to us today. Go and make disciples. Multiply. Grow. Be fruitful. So it was then in Genesis and Exodus. It was in New Testament times in the first century, and it is true today for you in the 21st century. We're still commanded to be fruitful and to multiply. But the people multiplied so much, it just became too much for the king. He was worried that there was going to be so many people that if their enemies attacked, that they were going to have this force within who could join with their enemies and attack from within. They'd grown by hundreds of thousands of people. Some of the commentators reckon there were 2.5 million people who left Egypt. 70 came in. 2 million go out. That's quite growth, isn't it? They came in a family. They would go out a nation under God. The king was frightened. Verse 11. So they put slave masters over them to oppress them and force labor from them. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. The more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. The same is exactly the same today. For it's always been like this through the ages. The church, the people of God, have always been under oppression, always persecuted. Many people try to eradicate the church and still do. But there's no way the church can be eradicated. Not because we're big and strong and really good at this, but because Jesus said, not even the gates of hell would prevail against the church. So as we look at our own church in our own land or in the West and we think, what is happening to us? In one sense, we need to fear and change, but in another sense, we don't. Because the gates of hell will not stop the church of God growing. They tried to eradicate the church in China in the early 20th century. They got rid of all the missionaries. They shot all the pastors. They tried to chop the head off the church. And today, China is on the verge of becoming, numbers-wise, the biggest Christian nation in the world. And groups today like ISIS and other terrorist groups, their number one target is Christians. You used to hear about it. You don't hear about it so much, but there are Christians being persecuted today, beheaded today, losing their jobs today, losing their lives today. The number one target, because Satan doesn't want the church. Satan doesn't want Jesus to be known or worshipped. But the gates of hell shall never prevail against the church. And it's often the way when there's oppression, when the church is oppressed, it grows. But chapter 1 is a picture of the desperation of the people. We're thinking of chapter 1 and chapter 2. The desperation of the people. These people were destined by God to be blessed by God, to be taken into a promised land, and to be blessed. He was going to transform them. They'd be taken from slavery and obscurity and made an identifiable nation so that all the other nations could look at them and see God is at work, and this is how you worship him. They were meant to be a light to the nation. That was their destiny. God was going to transform them. But often, before transformation, there is desperation. We know this in our own lives. Someone goes to the doctor and says, "Doctor, I'm really not very well." And the doctor says, "If you don't change your lifestyle, if you don't change your eating habits, if you don't get more exercise, if you don't transform yourself, serious things will happen." Desperation can lead to transformation. And so it was with these people. These people in Egypt were completely desperate. They had grown. A new Pharaoh had come who knew Joseph, and Joseph had done good things. But the new Pharaoh did not know Joseph. He didn't know anything about Joseph. And all he saw was a people who were growing, and he was threatened by that. So he oppressed them and put them into slavery. Hard work. Nothing much has changed over the last 3,500 years. Modern day slavery is the fastest growing crime in the world. There are an estimated 45 million slaves in our world today. When we think about slavery, you might think about an 18th century cotton plantation and slaves picking cotton. We don't often think about a slave being in the semi-detached house next door to us. But that's where modern-day slavery takes place. People who are oppressed and forced into labor or war or prostitution or work or whatever it might be. 45 million people at least in modern-day slavery. We think of it as, we call it, people trafficking. It's happening here where we live, and we're not aware of it. What can we do about it? I'm not really sure. Write to your member of parliament. Pray. But it's not something that we should be unaware of. Slavery has not been abolished. Where there are people, there will always be oppression. People looking to make money out of other people. Humanity is very frail and very evil. Genesis 1 says this. God says, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. This passage talks about human dignity. Everyone who's ever lived and everyone who lives today, whether they're rich or poor, whatever, are made in God's image. This talks about their dignity, not about who they are or how clever they are or how skilled they are or anything that they can do. This is a transcendent value that comes from God. Everyone is made in God's image. And so everyone deserves respect. But we so easily reduce people to a price tag. How we can use them, how we can abuse them. Isaiah says this in chapter 58, "If you spend yourselves on behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness." If we can somehow do something, pray something, write something to help those who are oppressed, it's like a bright light rising into the darkness, and that's what God calls us to do. Slavery is an evil thing. Jesus said that he came to set the slave free, the captive free, because Jesus sees the true extent of slavery. And it's not 45 million people. It's you and me and everyone who's breathing on this planet. We are all enslaved to sin, to our selfish ambition, to lust, to greed, to whatever it might be, but we're all enslaved. But the good news is, a deliverer has come, one who can bring us out of the slavery of Egypt and into the promised land of his kingdom. So Pharaoh upped the pressure. Verse 15, "The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shifra and Pua, when you help the Hebrew women in childbirth, observe them on the delivery stool. If it's a boy, kill him." He was desperate to get rid of the boys. He was desperate to see this population shrink. He was desperate to work them to death. The things we do. As the vote on the Eighth Amendment comes closer, and it's all over the news, there'll be lots of talk of the rights of a mother or the rights of a child. Abortion is a huge issue that we can't easily dismiss and we should not ignore. In the weeks to come, leading up to that date, which will probably be towards the end of May, we'll be thinking about this, and we'll be thinking about our own church's position on that matter. But the most important thing is not our church's opinion or the opinion of anybody, but on what God's word says to us. Life is a God-given gift. Life is precious at every stage. The Psalms tell us that he is the one who knits us together in our mother's wombs. The book of Job tells us that it is the Lord who gives life and who takes life away. And this passage, well, it's a beautiful picture of how respect for God should always outweigh any other consideration, even the orders of a king. No doubt these midwives were frightened. They would have been frightened of the king. He could have done anything to them. But they chose to obey God rather than man and refused to kill the babies. And so Moses is born. He's hidden in the bulrushes, as we know, for 3 months. And he was hidden at home for 3 months before he was put in the bulrushes. Verse 3, when she could hide him no longer, she got a basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the banks of the Nile. Hebrews 11 says this was an act of faith. The word used for basket isn't a word that's used very often. And you'll find it, where will you find it, Caroline? Genesis chapter 6, the story of Noah. In fact, the old-time versions, the King James Version, use it. She placed him in an ark. It's the same Hebrew word, tiba. It actually means box or a chest. But God commanded Noah to build a tiba. And he also commanded Moses' mother to place him in a tiba, an ark. In the first instance, the ark protected Noah from the floods, the waters of the flood. In the second instance, he was protected from the waters of the Nile. But it's a lovely word of protection because these people were important for the future of God's people, Noah and Moses. So as we read this, and as the original readers would have read that, it was meant to remind them of the past, how God had rescued humanity in the past at the time of Noah and placed him in a tiba, a box, a big box. And now today, how Moses was placed in a tiba, a box, a small box. And as we read this, we're meant to be reminded of God's provision all the way through, how God takes care of his people, how God's plan is always fulfilled. God is always at work. He's always working out his plan of salvation. So Moses is born. His mother hides him. She probably knew that royalty bathed in that part of the Nile, and that's why she would have placed him there. The princess comes along with her attendants to bathe in the Nile, and she spots the baby, and she feels sorry for him. We all love a baby, don't we? Oh, the poor little thing, spotted by royalty, and she takes him home. But the wonderful thing is that he ends up with Moses' mother because Moses' sister, Miriam, was watching from afar. And when she sees him being rescued by the Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, she goes to him and says, shall I get one of the Hebrew women to feed him for you and look after him for you? He said, that's a great idea. Get someone. And the best part is, she got paid for doing it. Isn't it wonderful? You're giving your baby back and you're paid for doing it. It couldn't get any better for Moses' mother. Then he had all the benefits of an Egyptian education growing up in a palace. Can you imagine it? But then verse 11, one day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and he watched them at their hard labor. Moses watches the Hebrews enslaved. And the word that's used there just doesn't mean that he saw with his eyes. It means that he saw with his heart and he was burdened for them. He took action. He saw one of the Hebrews being abused by an Egyptian, and you know what he did? He fought the Egyptian and killed him. He knew he'd done wrong. He buried the body. He thought he got away with it, but he hadn't. The next day, some people, well, they knew, so he went on the run. He did wrong things. He acted in a wrong way, but he had a strong, innate feeling for what was right and what was wrong. He had all the instincts of a deliverer, a rescuer. But he wasn't ready for that, but he had that instinct. He fought a Hebrew. He fought the Egyptian to save the Hebrew. The next day he saw two of the Hebrews fighting. He intervened to say to the one that was doing wrong, why are you doing this? And you remember later on as he goes into the wilderness and there's the girls and go into the well and the shepherds come along to chase them away. Well, Moses went and he fought off those shepherds and looked after those girls. So there was something about being a rescuer. In fact, that's what the girls said to their father. He delivered us from those who were attacking us. That was his role. So we had all the instincts of a deliverer, but he was not ready to do that. He didn't have the character of a deliverer. And so God took him into the wilderness to form his character, to shape him ready to lead a nation. And as I was reading this, it reminded me of the SAS. You know, the Special Air Services, one of the world's most elite regiments. I was reading this book. No, I wasn't reading this book. But I was reading something off this book. Twice a year, 150 recruits gather because they want to join this elite regiment. And they're put through 4 months of the toughest military training ever. And less than 10% of them get through. So it's not necessarily the strongest or the fittest, but there is something about a character of a man that gets him through, that can see him through, that will be able to join that regiment, 4 months of a selection process. For Moses, the selection process was easy, for he was selected before he was born. That was the easy bit. The hard bit was the training. Not 4 months, 40 years in a wilderness, being trained, being prepared, to learn patience, to have wisdom. Physically, he was getting weaker as he got older. But spiritually, he was growing stronger. And God was teaching them this amazing lesson that it was not about Moses and what he could do. It was about God and what he could do. Moses was simply an instrument, a tool in God's hands. And it took 40 years of preparation. And 40 years spent in this bit of land that he would take the people into for another 40 years. So he would have been familiar with this land. Isn't it great the way God prepared him for where he would bring 2 million people? And when God called him, as we'll think about next week, or rather Terry will think about next week, when God said, Moses, from a burning bush, then he was ready. God is always working, always planning. Do you ever feel in your life that you haven't quite done what God's meant you to do? Disillusioned, frustrated? God has got a plan, and it is a perfect plan. And for everybody in here who loves Jesus, he has got a plan, and he's working out his purpose through the hardship, through the pain, through the loss, through the disappointment. Sometimes God has to strip all of these things away to show that with God, anything is possible. But without him, nothing is. This is our God on this great journey to a new life. Not just for Moses, not just for the people, but for you and for me.